All right.
Right. You good?
I'm good.
Right.
12:38 market.
Okay. So, good evening, everybody. This is episode 5 of the Climb Side podcast with Brian Rigby.
Hey, everyone. And Tom Herbert.
Thank you. So, tonight, we are going to be talking about what we believe are the most useful or the top supplements that climbers could use, and why they could, and the reason why we choose these and not the multitude of supplements that are out there.
Precisely. Supplements, I think, are sometimes they're kind of polarizing, I guess. It feels like a lot of people are all in on supplements. You go to some of the mass market gyms and you just look at the state of the industry and there's hundreds, if not thousands, of supplements out there. And most of them probably do nothing, but the fact is people seem to love them. Or on the other hand, people are completely against them and believe that there's no benefit at all, that you can get everything you need from food, and that anyone who takes a supplement is a fool or perhaps a cheater even. And we try to, or I take at least try to take a middle approach to it. There are supplements that are worth taking, and there are certainly many that are not worth taking. You don't have to believe in bulk, in all supplements or no supplements, in order to have an opinion about them or to get the most benefit out of them. In fact, you're benefited from taking an individual approach, looking at what might work, what we have reasonable evidence to believe will work, and going from there.
Yeah, and I think before we start, let me give you a definition. So this is a good definition that was recently published by the International Olympic Committee. So they state a supplement is a food component, nutrient, or non-food compound that is purposely ingested in addition to the habitually consumed diet with the aim of achieving a specific health and/or performance benefit. And then I've got a little ellipsis, and then I say, the performance enhancing supplements, this is quoting them again, performance enhancing supplements should be considered only when there is strong evidence-based supports that, oh, sorry, only where a strong evidence base supports their use as safe, legal, and effective, and ideally after the adequacy of sports nutrition dietary practices is ensured. So there we have a kind of general outline of what is a supplement versus our food that we eat. And it really is. I mean, the clue is in the name, supplement. Both Brian and I, well, if I can speak for Brian, because I assume this is how he works, is that we always, when working with people, supplements come really last. It's a case of looking at how someone's doing with their daily intake, their habitual eating, and then supplements come in to try and augment something specifically, or to tweak something. Or to maybe improve something in terms of an outcome or a health need, say, for instance, special populations, vegan, vegetarians.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, supplements make their way into my plan. They're pretty much always there, but they are not the important part of it. And I would never, charge someone just to make a supplement recommendation. I mean, if you have questions about supplements, I answer those questions all the time for free via climbing nutrition. Always help to help, happy to help people with dosage or, what is effective or what isn't. That's not the bulk of the work. And that's also not the bulk of the improvement that people will see via meeting with a nutritionist, or a coach of any sort. They're not going to, you're not going to get a mega benefit out of any single supplement, at least provided that there's not some major problem going on, in which case probably a supplement is the least of your worries, even if a supplement could significantly fix that problem.
So what I have in my notes is I've broken down what I call general supplement classifications. So what we can think of is that you have supplements can be fortified foods, So those are vitamins or mineral-enriched foods. You've got formulated foods. So those would be things like sports products, so sports drinks, recovery shakes, gels, and bars. Then we have single nutrient supplements. So those would be single vitamins or something like creatine monohydrate. And then you have the multi-nutrients, which are normally the things that you find in tubs. So those are like the pre-workout or something, you know, or Monster Smash 3000 Power Anabol or something like that. You know, I tend to steer people away from anything that's a multi-nutrient supplement generally. Sorry, carry on, Brian.
I was going to say that I like that those classifications. I use slightly different one. At least how I kind of think about supplements, which is that, you know, most supplements are either nutrient-based, they're, you know, nutrients you can find in food, or they're drugs. These are also sometimes nutrients you can find in food, but I guess the difference is one has a more nutritive action upon your body. They're, you know, you absorb them, you incorporate them into whatever tissues need to be incorporated, and you get passive longer term benefit out of them usually. And then there's drugs like caffeine, for example, where the benefits are often much more acute and often much more potent. Drugs, it should be noted, by and large, the effect of drugs are banned because they, in addition to having potent positive effects, they often have potent negative effects when not used within a medical context, in which, you know, that negative effect is often overrided by the greater overall positivity of whatever the health outcome is. And you can also, I think, divide those food-based nutrients into ones that you can find in a reasonable amount within your diet and ones that you cannot find within a reasonable amount for a given outcome within your diet. And that's, I guess, where I kind of draw my own lines on what, you know, before looking at research necessarily, before, you know, just looking at the reasonability of what we might expect to have an effect. So things like vitamins and minerals for most people, food is your best source of it. It's completely reasonable that any person can get any given vitamin or mineral from their diet. And there are exceptions, of course. I don't think we'll get into those exceptions in this because none of the exceptions are particularly relevant for performance. But there are exceptions, for example, iron for women, where sometimes it's just challenging and an iron supplement could be warranted. And then there's, you know, supplements like beta-alanine or creatine, which we'll talk about today, where you could hypothetically get, and you do get these nutrients, it's maybe not fair quite to call them nutrients, but you could get these substances from food, but it's not really realistic, or it would require an overly onerous amount of challenge to get that much. So it just makes more sense to get them purified and simplified and be able to just take a, you know, a much smaller dose to get the maximum effect.
Yeah, definitely. So I have another heading here, which I say good reasons for supplement use. And the here I've got here is to correct nutrient deficiencies that may impact health and performance, convenient provision of energy or nutrients. So those would be the kind of sports products. Mm-hmm. And then I have two separations here. I say for direct performance benefits. So that's during competition. So during an event or something. And then indirect performance benefits, which are things like improving your recovery or improving your training output. And those will cross over anyway, but there are some supplements that are more useful after training or after an event. And there's some that are beneficial immediately within that event. And then I've got poor reasons for supplement use. And unfortunately, this is where a lot of people tend to be in the just in case mentality. You know, I'm going to take, and this is a lot with vitamins, where people think that more is better, or just taking just in case they're not getting enough. And it would be good to chat about that because I know Brian takes a hard line on that, and he's written a really good book on it, which I have read a couple of times. And then I've got a point here that says because so and so uses it. This goes into the marketing, you know, a lot of people will use a supplement because they saw someone using it and think that that supplement has got that person to where they are, which is kind of silly because normally supplement companies go after world-class athletes after they're world-class athletes. So them taking the supplement is normally, you know, after 10 years of being badass at what they do. So
it's anecdotal evidence. It's just pure and straight. You can't look at any one factor at any athlete and say this is what made them who they are, with the exception perhaps of genetics. Mm-hmm. We can always say, you know, world-class athletes are always going to have good genetics. Everything else is, you know, a combination of really hard work, their own, you know, training plan, their nutrition. Yes, the supplements that they take is all going to fold together, but you can't isolate any of those factors and think that just by changing one thing in your own diet or in, within your, you know, life, that you will suddenly become as good of a climber or athlete.
Mm. Yeah, and that goes into my last one, which is this latest, it being the latest market, latest product on the market, and the whole marketing spiel. And I think that's the important thing is to think about this, is that, you know, supplements are ultimately beneficial because they augment what you're already doing. And this is the trouble with it, is that we live in a culture that is so caught up in kind of instant results, that there is this feeling that if I'm not doing well in the sport, we're doing climbing podcasts, so let's talk about climbing. If I'm not doing well, if we're not doing well in climbing, you know, like I'm not strong enough, or, you know, or whatever, there is a feeling that there's something missing, either in the diet or in terms of the supplement, and that just by doing that, that's actually going to cause the biggest change. And it's not really that. Where supplements can help, and as we'll talk about various different supplements, is that really they are just allowing, in the most part, you to push yourself a little harder, go for a little longer, train and maybe an extra day or an extra few hours a week. And this really is the mentality I think that people should have with supplements specifically, is that they are the kind of the cherry on the top of what you're already doing. If you have a fantastic training plan and you're consistent with that, and your lifestyle factors are on point, that means you're eating well, you've got your macros right, which, you know, you please go back and listen to our other podcast where we talk about fat, protein, and carbohydrates. You've got your sleep well, you're reducing your stress. All of these factors are kicking in to help you. The supplements come in just to give you that extra bit more, that you can just push a little bit harder. And especially during, say, a competition, it gives you that little bit extra that you can tap into. So that's really where supplements come in. They are supplemental, and they provide an augmentation to how good you already are. You know, you're right. Yeah, carry on, Brian.
Yeah, it's you know, it's just as Tom said, it's a very incremental benefit, and it's often so small that on any individual day you're not going to notice that difference. It's the culmination of having that little bit more, you know, that extra 1 or 2%, or sometimes maybe just a little bit more, and being able to train that much harder, which builds. You know, you get a harder training session and a better training session a little longer, or you train, you know, an extra day within a week because you have that reserve available to do it, then you are absolutely going to improve at a better rate than somebody who doesn't have that small edge. And when you improve slightly, you know, faster than somebody else, then you gain an advantage over that person. Now, you know, this is looking at it from perhaps a competitive perspective, but you can look at it just against, you know, perhaps that other person is, you know, a shadow self who is not taking those supplements and is therefore not improving quite as much as he could be, he or she being you, if that's not too confusing. And it's the same, even if you look at the world of you know, these banned drugs that can get you eliminated from competitions, it's the exact same thing. None of them give you such a strong, or I should say almost none of them, probably none of them. I'm not, my knowledge of banned drugs is perhaps not as strong as my knowledge of supplements, but none of them are going to gain you just like an instant benefit, with the exception of maybe like cocaine or something. Most of them allow you to train harder. They allow you to recover faster. And that, combined with your already arduous training schedule, allows you to push that much better than your competitors and perform better within races or within events. You know, almost none of it is just these acute short-term benefits. Most of it is within these cumulative benefits. And so it's really hard. You know, a lot of people expect to feel these benefits right away. And when they don't feel that benefit, they assume that something isn't working, but it's too hard to look at it that way. You can't actually feel the difference all the time. And in fact, most of the time you can't.
Mm. Yeah.
So we're going to try to help reframe the way you think about effective supplements so that you don't get into that mentality.
Yeah. And that's good. Cause that leads, I mean, the fact that you're talking about banned substances, so that leads me to supplement safety. But just to reiterate, so, you know, if we look at something like anabolic steroids, fundamentally, the reason that anabolic steroids work so well is because they allow people to train insanely high amounts. It's really about a recovery. That what's happening is that the hormones are changed to such a degree that you are able to recover within, well, hours versus what would have taken you days to become. So it really is like a Captain America type thing. And this is why these guys, you know, got so huge and still get so huge is because the anabolic steroids allow them to put the work in. So that's really what it is. And even if you're looking at why things are on the banned list, prohibited list, is fundamentally it's because over the periods of whatever years that athletes have been doping, they've been able to put in more training than everybody else. And this is where the kind of unfair advantage is. So it's not that these are magic chemicals that improve everything. It's just really the fact that you can train harder. So that's the mindset. Keep that in mind, is that actually the best thing you can do is train as hard as you can and support that training and recovery with ultimately food and lifestyle and some supplements.
Precisely.
So in terms of safety, let me just do the safety bit, Brian.
Yeah.
So basically, I've got here, so do not assume that supplements have the same safety checks as whole foods. In different countries, supplements are regulated differently. So in America, I think the FDA doesn't regulate supplements.
No, it's a kind of a wild west.
Yeah. And I say, don't fall for marketing hype. There are great resources, such as websites like examine.com, which will help you guide. It will guide you on actual research data on the nutrient. It's a good place to start, examine.com. Then I say here, for professional athletes who compete under anti-doping code, such as the World Anti-Doping Code, they must check the latest WADA prohibited list. There may be some pro climbers here. I believe, speaking to some of the Team GB guys, that there is testing. Testing does go on. It's not as prolific as other sports yet, but as things come closer to the Olympics, I'm sure they're going to be ramping up testing. Mm-hmm. So you do go to the WADA prohibited list. That's important because it's not just supplements, that can be also medicines that you take. Consuming prohibited substance will result in an anti-doping rule violation. Often consuming a prohibited substance is unintentional. So you get like a positive drug test because you were taking some medicine or something. But also where it comes into supplements is, if you are taking something like a multi-nutrient supplement that you've just bought online or from a kind of bodybuilding shop, because the tub, you know, makes great claims about gains, you've got to be careful, because there was a recent study and it was something like something crazy, like 15% of a type of supplement. I think it was like a weight gainer or something, had traces of anabolic steroids and things in there. So I think it's unlikely that climbers are going to be looking at those sort of products anyway, because we're not all trying to get big and swole. But just be aware, you know, you can't just assume that you can go into any shop, sports shop, and buy something off the shelf and that it's clean. So one of the best places to go is something called Informed Sport. Mm-hmm. And Informed Sport has drug tested products. And you can actually look at the brands, and that will list either the manufacturing facility is drug tested, or the specific products themselves are batch tested. So you can go all the way and be as safe as you can with the products you do choose to use.
Yeah. And I believe that they have some stipulation to something about some sort of insurance, I think, on those products, that if maybe they don't. I don't know how they would actually.
There's something about you can, that, but. Yeah, you can get a certificate. So if you buy a product, you get the certificate for that batch from the manufacturer. And then there's some liability going down that if the seal hasn't been broken when you bought it, you can, I don't know. But basically there's a difference between, for instance, buying your whey protein from China for cheap versus buying it from a company that's listed on Informed Sport batch tested. You just got to be wise with this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think as well is that for people who are younger and are listening to this and are wanting, for instance, to make it into a pro team or think that they actually have the capability to get into a pro team in the future, this does affect you. You need to be careful not to just buy any old supplement because, this can really destroy your reputation if you unintentionally took something that you got from somewhere that was contaminated, which is unlikely, but it still needs to be thought about. So, be wise with the things that you take. You have two resources here that if you have a query about a supplement that you would like to use, then by all means, contact Brian or myself to just ask, is this a good supplement? Is this worth taking? And is it safe?
Yeah. And this is really like when we talk about safety, it's really aimed more specifically at competitive athletes. We don't see like general health safety.
No.
That's not really an issue when we're talking about supplements, at least provided you're not buying them from some shady dealer that you have no idea what's really in it. It's not like a personal health safety. It's a safety for your reputation and for your ability to compete within a sport. If you are a competitor, then I think we both would highly recommend you use that Informed Sport or Informed Choice list. I think there's a couple websites, but they're related. I'm not 100% certain what the difference between them is, but look for Informed by Sport and buy supplements that have been batch tested. Just do yourself the favor and do that. They typically cost a little bit more, but these are companies that are willing to stand by their products and have them randomly batch tested just to ensure that these contaminants aren't in them. And the contaminants are, it's not a widespread problem. Like, I don't want to say that it's guaranteed to happen, but it is enough of a problem that I would say you're way better off doing that. Don't be that person who, wins a competition, gets randomly drug tested and winds up with trace amounts of, some random banned substance in their blood, loses the pot, loses the medal, and is banned from the sport for, a period of time. That would just be a horrible outcome when you put so much time and effort into it. It would just be a terrible outcome to save, a few bucks on a supplement. Especially when, like, as we both mentioned, as we kind of prefaced, none of these supplements are going to make such a big difference that is probably the one thing that, won you that competition in the first place. Don't risk your competition. If you can't, if you can't afford the more expensive Informed by Sport supplement, that is okay. Tom and I would both recommend, if you are a serious competitor, forgoing a particular supplement over choosing just any random one.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so with that being said, so I have a number of supplements that
we both prepared lists.
Yeah, so
but we kept them secret from each other. I should say before we continue onto this, just very quickly, we made lists. This is an episode on supplements, but specifically on what we consider to be effective supplements.
Right. Yes.
There are tons of supplements out there, and perhaps in a future episode, we can talk about ones that we specifically would not recommend and why, because that can be, I think, very interesting too, just the thought process there. We're not going to talk about those this time, though, unless we disagree with each other.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean,
the ones that are effective.
Yeah, and also I assume is Brian's thing as well, is we're talking about supplements that have a performance benefit for climbing. So we're not necessarily talking about supplements that are going to aid with improving health. That we could probably do another podcast on. So yeah. I think we're pretty going to be on the same page on this. I mean, this list that I have is pretty much in order of the supplements that I would recommend potentially to my own clients and actually what I would take myself. So
mine as well.
Yeah. So this is where I'm coming from, is what I think is most useful. Okay. So let's have a look here. So
kick us off, Tom.
What is your number one?
Well, I was going to start at number 5.
Oh, we're doing it that way.
You know, it's so much more exciting for the listener when, you know, we're slowly making our way to number 1. Oh, what will the number 1 supplement be?
All right. Stay tuned. Okay. Okay,
I have 5 supplements on my list. And at number 5.
Yeah, okay, you go for it.
I put down sodium bicarbonate, aka Ooh. Baking soda.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Have you ever used baking soda?
Yeah, I have that. I have that as my 4.2.
4.2? What's the 0.2s coming in?
It will make sense. But let's go. Let's go for sodium bicarbonate. So, yes, I have used it. I've used it in 2 different ways. The first time I used it wrong. And, and I never made that mistake again. When we'll explain why in a minute. And then I have tried to use it correctly, but at the end of the day, I found that the benefits that I could somehow feel from it, which were low, was not worth the real hassle of it.
I am on the same page as you. It's okay. Number 5 on my list because I think it's an effective supplement, or it can be an effective supplement. Honestly, it's not one that I would recommend for most people, but I think there is a niche place here, and it is effective. So let's talk a little bit about why sodium bicarbonate is effective. If you know a little bit about your physiology, then you know that bicarbonate is the predominant buffer within our blood. It's what helps keep our blood at this nice, stable, about 7.2. And we use that to buffer the increasing acidity. So if we take a certain amount of sodium bicarbonate, it's not the sodium molecule that we care about within that. It's the bicarbonate, and you can't really get bicarbonate by itself. So, you know, we have to attach it to the salt or to the sodium ion. If you take enough of that, you can temporarily and very transiently boost the levels of bicarbonate in your blood. So bicarbonate has a pKa of 6.1.
So I've lost Brian. I'm still connected. So hopefully he will come back. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
I haven't gotten any notice that I'm off.
Did you hear me speaking? Okay.
I did. Yeah.
there was a freeze there. Okay, so you got to pKa.
Okay, right. So bicarbonate has a pKa of 6.1, which means that as acidity starts reaching, or as pH starts reaching 6.1, bicarbonate becomes a better and better buffer. It starts being more and more able to absorb the excess hydrogen ions that are being produced. Now, the unfortunate thing about bicarbonate and that very low pKa of 6.1 is that our muscles don't typically reach that low. If you're working really hard, they might get to around 6.2, the pH within your muscles, but that's really like end burn, you're done at that point. So it's not the most effective buffer that we have. And it is, when it is going to be effective, it's going to be effective right at the tail end of exercise, when you are almost falling off the wall, which can be useful. But you're not going to get any benefit out of it if you, you know, if you're just training and you're not pushing to that level every single time, every single, you know, set, then you're not going to get that benefit out of it.
So yeah, so the, a lot of the studies that I've done with sodium bicarbonate is are things like repeated sprint intervals. So it's this kind of glycolytic high intensity work that is going to be producing what everyone calls lactic acid, but it's really lactate level correlating with hydrogen ions. So that burn. So it's when it this is where it seems to have this benefit, is that it's a pH buffer, right? It's those hydrogen ion buffer. And if you can buffer that quickly, then the rate of fatigue might be delayed. And that's really where they've started looking at it. So we call sodium bicarbonate an extracellular buffer, because it's not really making it into the cells. It's the in the blood plasma and things like that. Now, because of this, is there is something to be said of actually using sodium bicarbonate on a daily basis as a way of improving your pH buffering. And by that, some people, for instance, will take a teaspoon before every meal. And there's a little bit of data on that to say that this might be a useful thing. The only issue with sodium bicarbonate is the fact that you're getting a lot of sodium. So whether or not this is an issue is another topic. But, you know, that's one of the issues with it, is that if you are taking and you're looking at about 4 to 5 teaspoons of baking powder to get the benefit acutely. But one of the problems, or this is one of the main reasons why both Brian and I won't really recommend it, and I've never really recommended it to anyone, is that from what I understand is that you change the osmolarity. Is that the right word? In the gut. Well,
you flood it with yeah.
Yes.
You basically make it so that you're sucking water out of the blood temporarily into the gut, osmotic diarrhea.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it is pretty violent if you get it wrong. So the way that people have, so put it like this, is that, you know, if you really have nothing to do and you're not going out anywhere, by all means, try this. You know, dump a couple of tablespoons of bicarb in some glass of water and drink that down, and then wait for about 30 to 40 minutes and you'll be on the loo in seconds. So the way that it has been done in studies and athletes, specifically cyclists, have been doing it, is that you can load it across the day in very small doses. So you spread the doses out, or you take it in capsules, or you can take it with food. But again, it's basically tastes like salt. It's horrible.
It's real, real bad tasting.
Yeah. I mean, like a teaspoon.
That I would actually say to me is the worst side effect of it. Not really side effect. It just is so foul tasting. It's so hard to drink.
Yeah, it's like drinking salt water, like seawater. If you were to put it like
worse.
One teaspoon.
It's like concentrated seawater. Yeah. It's so gross.
Yeah, so the thing is that, yes, there is some data to show that it can improve sprint performance because it delays the fatigue. The trickiest thing with it is the fact that it's to get the dose right, it's a lot. You're looking at 4 to 5 grams of 45 tablespoons of it. Four to five teaspoons of it, taking about 1 or 2 hours before the event. But the problem is that if you get it wrong, you just you will destroy your event, because you get gastritis.
This is 100% a supplement that, yes, you can benefit from it, but you absolutely must test it on yourself at some point where it's not your if you have to go sprint to the bathroom, it's not going to affect your competition. So you have to try it out beforehand. And there are ways that you can really minimize the chance that this happens. You know, and I'm not convinced that you can actually take it throughout the day because our body is so good at fixing, you know, the body wants your blood at that very specific pH. And it's so good at altering the pH to match that, that if you try to spread it out over a long period of time, it just is going to be able to catch up with it the entire time. The studies that I've seen that work, that have the greatest benefit, they all take it relatively rapidly. So the best way that I've discovered is to spread it out over the course of about an hour. Mix it with a decent amount of water. You're trying to dilute that, not just dilute the flavor of it, but also dilute the concentration of it so that it's much less likely to, you already have water there. You're much less likely to pull water from the intestines, from the blood to, you know, to try to fix the osmolality. So you're much less likely to diarrhea. It still tastes gross. I added a little bit when I have done it. I've added a little bit of sugar. Sugar, certainly in the context of a performance, isn't going to harm your performance at all. Or the context of a competition, it's not going to harm your performance at all. It might actually help. So the sugar is a benefit in some ways. It makes it taste a little bit better. But it's still, don't expect it to taste nice. It still tastes gross. And wear chapstick. Definitely wear chapstick. You put like an impenetrable barrier of oil between your lips and the drink, because if you don't, they will get severely chapped.
That I haven't heard. But
it
I have.
Might done, just be me. But yeah, no. Every time I've done it without chapstick, my lips have just gotten horribly chapped.
Do you don't drink margaritas much then?
I do, but you know, that's got nice rock salt on them. It's not this like concentrated salt solution or sodium solution. you lick the salt off the rim, and then you get the
true. Okay. Yeah. I mean, like you said, the only time I've ever recommended is I've said to people have a pint of water before you take it down, so you have that hydration first. So yeah. I mean, it's something for people to experiment with. By all means, experiment with. Where it could benefit is maybe not necessarily with climbing specifically, but maybe if, for instance, you're doing a very hard training session during the week, like a high intensity, either bodyweight training session or whatever, cycling or whatever, pull up plan or something, then maybe that would be a good thing for you to take for that training session. But I don't know. I don't see really whether the benefit of it would be actually in competition. But
I basically would recommend it. I mean, I think I would recommend it more for competition than for training, just because if you get one slightly better training session, you know, unless you're doing it consistently, which again, kudos to you if you can, because I'm guessing that if you try this, you're going to be like, oh, never again, not worth it. But kudos to you if you can. You probably could gain a lot of benefit if you did this once per week, you know, had one super hard training session. But more realistically, something like a competition, maybe a really important competition to you, after you've already tested it, and you have a routine down that's not going to give you any gastro problems, then take it, you know, that hour and a half before the competition, you'll be able to push slightly harder. It's going to be of significantly greater benefit to sport climbers in a sport climbing competition, just because bouldering is so much more reliant on, you know, power and not so much on power endurance. You're very rarely going to be reaching this 6.1. I'm not saying it can't benefit, because certainly when you have limited time between boulder problems, you're incentivized to get on them more frequently, and you're much more likely to actually encounter these power endurance problems. But sport climbers would get the most benefit out of it. Boulders, slightly less. And really, I wouldn't recommend it unless you are, you know, unless the competition is extremely important to you. Yeah. And then only if you've tested it and know that you can get away with it without suffering any gut problems. I listed adverse effect as volcano gut. So that's pretty much.
Yes.
And one other thing that I think is important to mention on this, You know, if you read my blog, you've probably read about citrulline malate at some point, an acid. Don't combine sodium bicarbonate right away with anything acidic. You got stomach acid's acidic. If you're, you know, so if you're doing it on like a full stomach, I wouldn't do that either. You know, minimize how much stomach acid is there by minimizing your food consumption beforehand. And then don't take it with any other supplement that would have a source of acidity within it. Because if you do that, then you're going to experience a different type of volcano gut where it comes out your mouth instead.
That's true. Yeah. So don't take it with margaritas, for instance.
Yeah. Do not try to improve the flavor of it with lime juice.
No. Right. Okay. So can I hazard a guess then that your number four is beta-alanine?
Oh, man. How did you guess?
Oh, really? Okay, good. Because that was, yeah, so that's my 4.1. My point was is that sodium bicarbonate didn't really make my list, but I wanted to put it in line with my number four, which was
okay.
Beta-alanine.
So, all right. I see it. Okay. It's kind of like 4A and 4B. Not like decimal tiers where you're going to have like 3.3s and 2.45s. Okay.
No. So beta-alanine is a type of amino acid that isn't actually incorporated into proteins. And it's a precursor to the synthesis of carnosine. And carnosine is an intracellular buffer. This is the other kind of the other part of it. This is why I mentioned so sodium bicarbonate being an extracellular buffer. So beta-alanine is doing the same sort of thing, buffering pH, but actually within muscle tissue.
And doing it at much more physiologically relevant levels.
Sure. Sure. this is buffering the hydrogen ions that are built up or build accumulating when they're dissociating from lactate. In terms of the benefits, they're similar to sodium bicarbonate. So what we can say is that meat eaters can get about a gram of beta-alanine a day. Carnosine, because carnosine is present in muscle tissue. So you would get that from animal products, but this is what Brian mentioned earlier, is that if you're wanting to get enough carnosine to be equivalent to dose that is seen in studies, it's not going to happen unless you're eating a huge amount of meat.
It's a lot of meat.
Yeah. So you're looking at about, to increase the carnosine levels in your muscles, you're looking at about 4 to 6 grams a day, divided into about 2 grams or less for at least 2 weeks. That's what the ISSN, International Society of Sports Nutrition, recommends. There's another recommendation, can be about 65 milligrams per kilogram. So that works out to be about 5 grams for, say, an 80 kilo person. And that's split into like 0.8 to 1.6 grams every 3 to 4 hours for 10 to 12 weeks. So with the big thing with beta-alanine is that it's not something that you're going to have an effect by just taking it and then doing your training or your climbing. It's something that you're wanting to build up these carnosine levels in your muscle. So it's different then in relation to sodium bicarbonate. So sodium bicarbonate is an acute pH buffer, which means that it can have their effect, and then once it's buffered, it goes. Carnosine is this molecule that you're going to be building up over time. ISSN says you can do that in about 2 weeks, and it basically varies from that. So they're saying after about 4 weeks, muscle carnosine concentrations can raise to about 40 to 60%. So anyway, the point being is that you're going to have to take this roughly about 6 grams a day for at least probably 4 weeks to have an effect in terms of.
And then you can usually reduce it. There is a cap to how much carnosine our muscles will store. It's not like you can keep taking it and it'll just keep on increasing it as much as, you know, as much as how much you're taking. There's a cap. So usually with this supplement, you'll see it divided into like a loading dose and then a maintenance dose, where the loading dose is about twice as high as the maintenance dose. The ISSN, those recommendations that Tom gave, that's the International Society of Sports Nutrition, by the way, for those who don't know the acronym necessarily, it's the certification, certifying body that Tom and I belong to and have our accreditation through. That's, you know, one really, though, there's not a ton compared to some of the other supplements that we'll talk about on the list. There's not a ton of data suggest like these are the amounts that have been tested that we know are effective. It's fully possible that we could gain slightly more benefit from slightly more, or, you know, shorten the loading time, or that we require slightly less for maintenance. But really it's kind of splitting hairs on that. If you take the dose that we know to be effective, then you can know that it will be effective, even if you could slightly change it and still have just as much efficacy.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the side effects of beta-alanine, this is a kind of a weird one. So most people have, you've tried it, beta-alanine, right?
Yeah, I take it pretty consistently.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I take it consistently. And then every, like, when after surgery, for example, when I wasn't exercising, I stopped taking it. But when I am training and climbing, I take it consistently.
Okay. I don't actually. I don't know really why. I think it's mainly because I just never had enough of a training load to feel that I was benefiting from it that much. But also, so this is the if you haven't tried beta-alanine, basically, and I forgot to put why it does this, so maybe you can explain to us why it has this effect. But basically, most people are going to get, depending on the length, the size of the dose, and whether you've eaten, are going to get basically like a flushing effect on your face and the back of your neck and maybe your hands, and like almost like pins and needles. And I think it's a dilation type. It's a dilation type thing, or?
I don't think that it's actually fully understood about why it's happening. Right now, we only have maybe some suspicions. But certainly, I don't think we have any concrete evidence for why it will cause this effect known as paresthesia.
And it's kind of pleasant when it first comes on, but it can last up to like an hour if you take a big dose. When I used to take it, I used to sit at my desk, because I used to take it just at the end of work before I started going to climbing. And I would just sit there kind of just rubbing my face for about 20 minutes, which feels really nice, because it just kind of like relieves this weird, like, hot itch. I don't know if you've had the same experience.
Yeah, I get kind of, it almost feels like a part of my body's asleep. It kind of shifts around. Oftentimes it's weird parts of the body that don't normally fall asleep, like my right buttock. So it's not necessarily unpleasant or pleasant. Everyone, you know, you'll have to experience it to know how much it bothers you or doesn't. It doesn't bother me that much, at least when I take a reasonable size dose, because it should be noted that the size of the dose influences how strong and how long the effect lasts. So you can completely avoid this effect by taking a dose of 800 milligrams of beta-alanine or less, and especially by taking that dose with food. If you take a larger dose with food, you'll probably get less of an effect, because it's just making its way into your bloodstream slower. You don't have the same spike of levels. And if you take a very large dose, then you'll probably experience quite a bit, and it'll last for quite a bit of time. But again, neither Tom nor I can tell you whether it'll be pleasant or unpleasant for you, because we've both heard it both ways. Some people really like the effect, some people really dislike it, and some people have no strong feelings about it one way or the other.
Sure. So again, the performance benefit is of this is going to be basically allowing you to go longer and harder because this buffering of the hydrogen ions.
It should be noted also that paresthesia, it is harmless. It doesn't cause any sort of health issues. It's not going to affect performance or anything. It's not going to affect your health. It merely makes you feel kind of strangely.
Mm. Yeah.
So don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Just be aware that it happens.
Yeah. And this is also why you'll find beta alanine put into so-called pre-workout supplements. And the reason being is I think people like the feeling just before they go to the gym because they think it's working.
Right.
But there's no correlation between the tingling you feel and the performance improvement.
Yeah.
In the gym.
Makes it feel effective, but it's a supplement that only benefits from chronic usage. It has zero acute benefit.
Right. Exactly. Okay. So that was number 4.1. Okay. So this is now my order is slightly out. So I might hazard a guess. Are you going to put caffeine as number 3?
Man, we're on the same page or you're cheating and looking at my notes.
No. Caffeine I put as number, because my list goes on whether or not I would recommend it. And caffeine I put as number 5, actually.
Number 5. Interesting. Okay. Not
as terms of efficacy, because it is very efficacious.
Effective
is the word. But anyways, okay. So let's tell us about caffeine.
Caffeine is it's the only drug that I've included on this list, and therefore it's the only one that really has a strong. Well, I should say it's the only one that has a strong acute benefit because we'll get to that one later. But it's the one that you are certainly going to feel the benefit of the most.
Yeah.
I assume most of you listening have probably had caffeine before. You know how caffeine feels and how it affects you. And you also know what sort of adverse effects can occur when you have too much of it. So the benefit of caffeine, I think, is maybe the less understood part of it. Because I think a lot of people, think it does more than it does. Mm-hmm. The benefit of caffeine really is in the mental. It's all mental. So it increases your focus, which has obvious benefit, especially for climbers, where focus is of such great importance compared to maybe a, distance runner or something. And it reduces your perception of pain and fatigue very slightly. So that lets you push through burn. If your muscles are burning from exertion, it reduces that sensation a little bit and it improves your mood. And when you're happier, you're more likely to train harder. And those are the benefits. From these direct benefits of caffeine, that's where the secondary benefits come into play. Things like increases in strength and endurance and feeling like you can go on forever. Caffeine's not actually doing those things. Caffeine doesn't increase your strength in any physical direct way. It does not increase your endurance, and it does not, increase the longevity of your workout. It just puts you in a better mental state to be able to give yourself those benefits, to push a little bit harder and to push a little longer.
Yeah. And the fundamentally the way it does this is that we talk about ATP, so adenosine triphosphate. So when we're breaking down this molecule, we start building up amounts of the adenosine. And specifically in the brain, this adenosine builds up and binds to certain receptors that basically make you sleepy or sedate you. And this is a kind of a feedback thing to tell your body now you need to go and rest and sleep. And overnight, you're body then metabolizes this adenosine, it frees it up from these receptors, and you feel awake. So you have these two receptors, one that makes you sleepy and the other one that keeps you awake. And what happens is that caffeine comes along and binds to these receptors so that the adenosine doesn't bind to them. So it binds to the A1 receptor, which tells your brain to be sleepy, and then it blocks that, so you don't have that. And the other one is keeping you basically awake or alert. and it blocks that, so it has the opposite effect. So what caffeine is basically doing is, which everybody knows, especially students, is it basically masks how tired you are, how fatigued you are. It also has effects on other organs. So for instance, your heart, when adenosine binds to receptors in your heart, it will slow your heart down. Caffeine comes along, blocks that because it binds to that receptor, so the adenosine can't. And so your heart beats faster. It also has effect on your kidneys. So whereas adenosine would tell your kidneys to slow down in the production of urine, caffeine does the opposite, which is why has a slight diuretic effect.
Although it should be noted that most people think caffeine is way more diuretic than it
really
is.
Yeah, I was just about to say, So so there was actually, I think in the last 2 years, there was a paper looking at this specifically to see whether or not someone becomes dehydrated by using coffee versus water. And there was no difference there. You are getting the same amount of hydration from water. Now, the application of that is debatable, but the point being is that you don't have to drink a glass of water with every cup of coffee you drink because it's going to dehydrate you.
I mean, but the main reason you pee more when you use caffeine is because all these things, the way you get caffeine is by drinking liquids.
Yeah.
Right. So liquids make you need to pee.
Yeah. I mean, certainly one of the things it will do, which everybody at some level understands, is that it is upregulating your nervous system. It's turning everything on. It's blocking the sedation, which is why you become like hypervigilant. You have a lower perceived exertion, and but also what happens is that it can also increase your anxiety levels. So you know, well, I'll give you a prime example. So I'm working with a guy who is currently out in China, and he asked me, he's not a coffee drinker, and he asked me about caffeine, and I said no, not at all. And the reason being is that he has little to no experience drinking coffee. He drinks it maybe once or twice a month the most, but he's never gone into a competition with caffeine. So I said, don't touch it, because we have no idea how it's going to affect his mood and his anxiety levels before he trains. What we are going to do is during the break between the next comp, we're going to have a look and test it. But we're going to test it by using gum. So we're going to have a look at a gum that actually has a specific amount of caffeine. So we know that this amount of caffeine has this amount of effect on him, and he's going to, you know, do a trial at the bouldering center or something like that. So this is let's talk about how much you basically need. So you're looking at about I have here about 210 to 420 milligrams of caffeine for an effect. So about 2 to 6 milligrams per kilogram of body weight before exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So to put that in perspective, so if you're looking at the high end of that, let's say 420 milligrams of caffeine about 30 minutes before exercise or comp or something, a double shot of espresso is about 80 milligrams of caffeine. A brewed black coffee or brewed cup of coffee is about 120 milligrams. I've never specifically dosed caffeine for any of my training. I certainly, the majority of my training, I don't take caffeine because it's mainly at like about 7 o'clock at night, which would not be a good idea. So this is the other thing. So there's a half-life of caffeine in your body, and it lasts about 4 to 5 hours. So again, if you're blocking these adenosine receptors, it's going to impact your sleep. And this is going to be the big problem with caffeine use, is that if it's impacting your sleep, then it's going to be impacting your training and your performance far more negatively than the benefit you're going to get of it. Caffeine as well is an incredibly good mask for the state of where you are. So if you are a habitual coffee drinker, is that you may be running low in terms of your energy levels, your overall health, but you don't really know because you're constantly just blocking this kind of feedback in your body. So that's where you've got to be careful with caffeine, is that it is incredibly beneficial. I love it. But there are times when I can abuse it by using it to kind of mitigate poor lifestyle habits.
Right. Caffeine is, I think, really interesting just because we have plenty of research that has listed effective doses and kind of looked into that. But we also know that, you know, the effectiveness of caffeine, as we've talked about, is it relates directly to how it makes you feel. And how it makes you feel is not, it doesn't follow, it's not, you know, as neat as 3 to 6 milligrams per kilogram.
Right, okay.
Some people require far less. Some people, you know, if they're habitual users, might require slightly more or need, you know, to be on the higher end of that range. If you are, pardon me, if you're caffeine naive,
meaning, do you need a glass? Do you want to get a glass of water?
I still have the weird throat thing relating to the whole chondrosarcoma. I'll be right back. I'm gonna get a little water.
No problem. I won't steal Brian's thunder. Unfortunately, I don't even know a song that I can sing. Not that I could sing. He should be back soon. If not, I'll tell you a story.
Okay, sorry about that. Got my glass of water, so hopefully that'll help. All right, as I was saying, if you're caffeine naive, meaning you are not taking caffeine, then you can't just jump in and assume that the 3 milligrams per kilogram is actually going to be effective. Because chances are it'll be way too much.
You're right. Okay. Yeah. So one of the ideas there is that there is that you can build up a caffeine tolerance, and the theory is that it's related to these receptors. So if you are constantly drinking, let's say, 3 cups of strong coffee a day, what happens is that you upregulate these adenosine receptors on the brain and in organs. And what will happen is that you keep having to take, say, well, let's first make an example. Say you have 10 receptors currently, and you take caffeine and it binds to all of those. And now you have the effect of caffeine there. But you keep drinking coffee. What will happen is that the body will upregulate the amount of receptors. So let's say it now has 20 receptors. What will happen is that now you have caffeine binding to 10 of them, and adenosine binding to the other 10, and adenosine is doing its job, meaning it's having a sedative effect. What happens is that you will then take more caffeine to try and then basically get the same feeling, and that means that you will be binding to more receptors and so forth. And this is also the idea why if you suddenly come off coffee, you suddenly become incredibly, well, some people feel terrible. You get headaches. You feel very, very fatigued. And that might be a kind of a psychological thing in terms of it. You feel different. You don't have that burst of energy. But also physiologically is what happens is that you now have all of these receptors available for adenosine to bind to, and you can kind of get this flood of adenosine coming in and knocking you out. So if you titrate coffee down, if you're feeling that you're abusing caffeine, you know, you're on the 4 to 5 cups a day, you can titrate that down. And as you titrate it down, you can basically balance out this kind of receptor binding thing.
Yeah.
And that's not a bad way of doing it. And it's also, to be honest, I always recommend people to have a try at kicking out coffee for a few weeks just to try and feel what it feels like. Just so you can have a balance of how you feel dependent on something or not.
Yeah. Yeah, caffeine, I don't know. I think on the whole, most people either use caffeine or don't, depending on their, you know, it's a lifestyle habit more than it's a performance or a training habit. Chances are, if you're using caffeine, or if you're the type of person who wants to use caffeine, you're probably already using it. For competitors, there might be a good reason for you to wean yourself off or titrate down your caffeine-contained drinks, as Tom mentioned, and then, you know, try to regain some of that stronger benefit, specifically for the purpose of a competition.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason to, you know, suddenly start taking caffeine habitually, because you'll get a little bit of benefit out of it, and then that benefit will perhaps dwindle some, and now you might just find yourself with a new addiction rather than a significant boost in performance.
Yeah, and so the other thing as well is then some people, and you'll fully find that some people just dislike coffee or how it feels, and that's actually, I think, mainly down to you. Genetically, people can metabolize coffee well or not, or very little at all. Interestingly, it's this, I think it's was CYP8 or something. Anyway, this it's a basically your liver detoxifies, it metabolizes this. And some people don't have the genetics for metabolizing coffee or metabolizing caffeine. And so what happens is that the effect of caffeine lasts longer in those people, and they feel pretty lousy. Whereas other people can have the opposite. They might metabolize caffeine very, very quickly, which is why they might just drink more coffee and not feel the effects. What's interesting about this is that this is same detoxification pathway is involved with the metabolism of a lot of other drugs, so medicines, as we call in the UK, for instance, things like, and this is interesting, things like grapefruit juice, you'll see with some of the medications that you take will tell you not to take with grapefruit juice. And the reason for that is that grapefruit juice actually inhibits this gene transcription, meaning that you would metabolize the drug or the medicine much slower. What it means, though, is that you can actually use this to your benefit. Is that if you were to drink a glass of grapefruit juice with your coffee, you can actually increase the length of your caffeine high, which is a small tip. If you want to decrease it, so I wrote an article about 3 years ago about this. I wish I could find it. It was on a Facebook post. But in theory, you could reduce the life of caffeine. So other things that cause so-called toxics effect in the body will upregulate this gene. So things like smoke from cars, cigarettes, charred meat, broccoli. These things actually upregulate
broccoli.
Yeah, these things actually upregulate the gene. So in theory, if you drunk too much coffee and you want to metabolize the caffeine quicker, you could smoke a cigarette.
Oh yeah.
Go outside into traffic while
performance nutrition at its peak.
While eating broccoli and a large charred barbecued steak.
Yeah, feeling a little jittery. Just have a cigarette. Don't have a cigarette. Don't do that. But it is true. Habitual cigarette smokers metabolize caffeine typically much faster.
Yeah, which is why you see that the classic coffee binge at the AA meetings.
Right. And I guess one, perhaps you have something else to mention about caffeine, but the last thing I have to mention is that there is an upper limit allowed in under the anti-drug rules.
Oh, yeah. Well done. Yeah.
So, and it's so high that honestly, if you're having this much caffeine, that I don't know what you're doing. You're going to feel terribly at any rate. The effective dose that you would need to take to flag yourself on a drug test is about 9 or more milligrams per kilogram of body weight, which is about 3 times as much as you need to get, that studies have shown to be effective. So just make sure that you're keeping your caffeine consumption below around, 400 to no higher than around 400 or 500 milligrams before a competition. And really, there's no reason you should be above that. You're going to feel terrible if you do.
Yeah. So again, like a double shot of espresso is 80 milligrams. A cup of coffee is about 120 milligrams. So if you're hitting that, you're drinking way too much.
Right.
One
other thing that I always mention is that caffeine can be extremely dangerous as well. If you're getting it from drinks, you're never going to be able to drink enough to, or probably never going to be able to drink enough to suffer any adverse effects. Even the energy drinks, a lot of people have kind of ascribed some of these. There's case studies about energy drinks causing these problems. Probably it was not caffeine related in a lot of these, but for sure, if you're taking like a powdered supplement, it's very easy to overdo it. I recommend to not ever buy powdered caffeine. It's just too easy, especially not purified powdered caffeine. Obviously, some like pre-workout shakes will have caffeine in them, but that's measured and dosed at a much lower rate, so you're safe with those. But don't buy like purified caffeine powder and then add it, because you very realistically can kill yourself if you just make a simple mistake in, if you use a tablespoon instead of a teaspoon or, what have you.
Yeah, there was actually a famous thing. I think it was a UK university. I don't know if you heard about that, where they were doing a caffeine study and they actually got the dosing wrong. And I think four people ended up in hospital. I just had a quick look. So I think a can of Red Bull has about 77 milligrams of caffeine. So about the same as a double shot espresso.
Yeah.
And also just to say, actually, the majority of pre-workout products or energy giving products or drinks or any supplements that you see as a kind of mixed supplement that promote energy with B vitamins and all this sort of thing, like almost all of them have a dose of caffeine equivalent to a cup of coffee. And that is what is causing the energy or the so-called feeling of energy. Right. It's not the B vitamins, I'm telling you.
So, taurine.
Yeah, so exactly. So be aware when you do pick up things like sports drinks or energy drinks or anything like that. So just have a look at the can the packet. And you're most likely going to see caffeine as the active ingredient there. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's move on.
All right.
So what are we on? Well, number two now?
We're on number two. I haven't made any guesses about what's on your list, but your list was really strangely organized. So I'm not sure if I want to make a guess about what you have for number two. How many supplements total are on your list?
So I would have, well, I have six here because I have 4.1 and 4.2.
Okay. That means one of them is not on my list.
No, one of them, I know why it wouldn't be on your list.
Okay. Interesting. Oh man. Well,
you're going to have a guess for that one because we don't have to cover it. We don't have to cover it because it's not.
No, we can cover it. That's not a problem. All right. I'll let you say it and then I'll.
Okay. So when I was creating my list, I was trying to think of the things that I tend to recommend to clients. And that's why this one made my list of supplements for climbers. Okay. And so what I put down here is I put vitamin D.
Okay. Interesting. I would not have guessed that.
Right. So the reason is really, and I don't want to go too much into this, but there is enough data that basically to say that if you're not getting exposure to sunlight for at least 20 minutes a day on your skin, that over time you can be developing a deficiency in vitamin D. And vitamin D is it's kind of ubiquitous in the body. It really has an effect everywhere, not just on what tends to be marketed, which is kind of bones and calcium absorption and things like that, but it can be related to things like gene transcription, modulation of cell growth, neuromuscular, immune. It reduces inflammation and things like that. So the reason I have it on my list is that, especially in the UK, is we just don't have great weather. so it's really a case of, well, as well as whether or not climbers are going to be spending majority of the time indoors training. Mm-hmm. And then when they do go outside climbing, maybe during the summer months, that maybe, yeah, they get the top up of vitamin D naturally, but that potentially are running low. So what I would say is that in the UK, you can get a vitamin D test. If you just search for vitamin D3 test, you're going to get a couple of sites that pop up, and they all pretty much point to the same testing lab in Birmingham. And you can get a vitamin D test for about £28. And it's worth doing to see where you stand. So what they test for is something called 25-hydroxyvitamin D. And what you're looking for is about, basically, what they say is 30 to under 50 nanomoles per liter is generally considered inadequate for overall health. And then there's higher end ranges on there. But what you'll get is that if you go and do this test in the UK, it's just a little blood prick test, and you send that to the lab, and it comes back in a week or so. Is that they'll give you a range of where you're sitting. And then you can make a decision on whether or not you want a supplement. And supplementation is so cheap and so easy. You're looking at, you can basically supplement with about 1,000 to 4,000 IU a day, and then do a test maybe 2 months later and see where you're going. So vitamin D is incredibly safe, unless you're taking multiple doses in multiple products. The high end of it is very high. I mean, I think half an hour in the blazing sun on a holiday, you're going to get about 20,000 IU in that half an hour or something like your day out in the sun. So it's very safe. But it's certainly the reason I put it in my supplement recommendations. And for many people, I will request to get the test done so we can see. I think it's easy enough a win to improve someone's health going forward by knowing where they are on vitamin D status.
Okay, that makes sense. Your rationale.
Oh, you're frozen. You still there? You still there, Brian?
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here now.
Okay.
Carry on.
It's not because I don't recommend it. That's not on my list. It's because it doesn't have the same sort of performance benefit as the other five that I have on my list. Okay. I do recommend it to pretty much everyone that I meet with. We don't have the same atrocious weather. Oh, I don't know if you'd call it atrocious, but we in Colorado, we have more sunshine than pretty much anywhere else that I know of. But we're still pretty high up in latitude. So there's a number of months a year that we just don't have strong enough sun to produce it through our skin. And also because we're so high up in elevation that pretty much, you know, I would recommend everyone to be wearing sunscreen at all times when they're climbing outside. It's very easy to get burned and, you know, suffer all the negative effects of having skin damage from the sun. So I recommend it as well to pretty much all my clients. It's, as Tom said, it's extremely cheap. You can get a year's worth of supplement for like $10 to $15. Mm. There is enough data to suggest that it is relatively commonly found in lower than ideal amounts. Actually, my wife just had a vitamin D test, and she was taking supplementation pretty high, and she wears so much sunscreen. She gets so much less sun exposure than anybody else I know, and her levels are actually deficient. So now she's on like medical strength vitamin D. I don't think that's super uncommon, and it's very easy and it's very safe. The only cases of vitamin D toxicity that I'm familiar with have all been related to contaminated milk. Milk in the United States is fortified with vitamin D, and it was like improper fortification. They accidentally threw way too much in, and so people drinking their daily milk were getting like 50,000 IU a dose, and that's where this toxicity came from. Otherwise, we see zero issue with it. So yeah, it's not on my list, but it is something that I would not hesitate to recommend.
Cool. Okay, so we're on number two, right?
Hey.
So I think Yeah, so my list now is probably not in the same order as yours, because I think you're taking a bent on it, on the performance element of it. So I think I know what your number one will be, but so tell me, what is your number two?
I have for number two, creatine.
Oh, okay, so you do have that as number two.
I do have it as number two.
So that's my number two as well.
Perfect. In line. Okay.
Right. So now this is a good this is a good one.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to discussing this one because it is controversial.
Right. So now, if you remember, for those who are listening to other podcasts, when we're talking about the energy systems. So easiest way to think about it is your creatine your phosphagen system is the first system that is going to be providing or recycling the ATP for your muscles. So if you were to jump off your chair or jump up in the air or do something, that initial energy that is being used by the muscles and the cells is the free ATP in within them in the cells, and the immediate hydrolysis of phosphocreatine to take the phosphate and reattach it back to the ADP, which you just took the phosphate off. Remember, so you break ATP, adenosine triphosphate, into adenosine diphosphate, and that breaking is what releases the energy. Creatine or phosphocreatine is a creatine molecule bonded to a phosphate. So it's just one little chemical reaction that snaps it off and transfers that phosphate back to the ATP so that you can use it. So this is why creatine or the phosphocreatine system is basically the first where they kind of put into this kind of 10 seconds of movement, or the primary energy recycling mechanism. Because it's such a quick step, there's not multiple steps. It's a snap and attach to recycle.
Right. Yeah, this is where our power comes from and our ability to sustain power. Climbing is a powerful sport, and you know whether you're sport climbing or bouldering, the power that you need for it must come from something that is rapid, an energy system that is rapid enough to regenerate that free ATP and give you that energy to continue. And the aerobic systems simply aren't fast enough. And we have a relatively limited capability through anaerobic glycolysis compared to regenerate that, at least compared to our creatine phosphate system. So creatine, its benefit is that we can increase the levels of the phosphocreatine within our muscles by anywhere from 20 to 50%, depending on what your levels were starting at. And that's a pretty significant boost.
Yeah. Yeah. So think about that. So you have, if you're going in and, you know, we'll talk about it, but you produce creatine, obviously. And you can also get some creatine from eating animal products because you're eating muscle tissue and things like that. But we know, and I actually put something up on my Instagram literally 2 days ago, that a study just came out looking at creatine in omnivorous women and vegan vegetarian women. So go to Useful Coach or Instagram Useful Coach, and you'll see the little infographic. And they do vegetarian vegan population has a lower percentage of creatine compared to omnivorous. So if you can increase your phosphocreatine levels in your muscles from up to 50% more, this is an incredible performance benefit in terms of this reserve of immediate power energy that you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, significant benefit to performance. Climbers, for whatever reason, the sports scientists haven't deemed climbers ready to be, you know, the main focus of all their studies yet. So we have to look at other types of athletes, unfortunately. But what we do see consistently in other types of power athletes, sprinters, weightlifters, other athletes who kind of are working out in this 10 second to minute and a half long range, is that creatine just has a number of it improves performance overall. And we see that consistently improved performance, and it improves your ability to train, and therefore, as we mentioned right at the beginning of the show, your ability to kind of stack on these gains over time. for climbing.
Yeah, carry on.
I think there's an interesting benefit that we can look at specifically with climbing, which is that creatine increases what's called your relaxation velocity.
Oh, this is a new one. I haven't heard this.
So basically, you know, you grab onto something, right? And it's a hold, it's a challenging hold, and your muscles contract in order to, you know, stay attached to it. When you let go, the muscles don't instantly relax. It takes a bit of time, obviously. So relaxation velocity is how fast your muscles are able to relax from that contraction. And there have been studies that have shown that within climbers specifically, more advanced climbers or better climbers have faster relaxation velocity within their forearms. When they let go of a hold, their muscles relax sooner, with the most obvious benefit of that being that once your muscles are relaxed, you're able to pump blood through them again, restore oxygen, start, you know, using the aerobic energy system to restore more energy. And so you recover a lot faster between, you know, on a climb between holds. And creatine in other studies has been shown to increase relaxation velocity, specifically within the forearms. So seems like a pretty direct benefit there.
Yeah, do send me that. I had not come across that. That's really fascinating.
Yeah. So, and then creatine has these other benefits. You know, it's not just a power system. When creatine is, it also acts as a buffer, because you know it's a way to absorb, when it resorbs hydrogen ions, when we regenerate creatine back to creatine phosphate, it absorbs hydrogen ions. So that means that it's actually taking them out of the muscle, reducing, or I guess increasing the pH, letting you carry on perhaps a little longer.
Yeah, it's because it's an anaerobic energy substrate. The benefits of it are there in terms of it's not requiring oxygen. That's why it has shown, I think because of that reason, there's a decreased risk and enhanced recovery from mild traumatic brain injury. There's other benefits, such as it can, there is some data to say that it may help with recovery from exercise, so delayed onset muscle soreness, DOMS, improved cognitive processing. There's some new data that is coming out in a lot of brain issues, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and things like that, looking at creatine supplementation. There is some data on creatine supplementation and depression. And I think almost all of this is related to is that you're providing this energy substrate that is immediately available. And if you're increasing the energy available of certain cells, this can be beneficial. Certainly if you're having problems with things like insulin resistance, where, you know, for instance, they're talking about some mental diseases being a kind of insulin resistance of the brain, meaning that it doesn't have the glycolytic machinery to power the cells. So by increasing creatine levels, there is this energy availability to the cell for it to survive.
Right. So far, you know, creatine probably sounds great. And it wouldn't be on our list if Tom and I didn't overwhelmingly think that it was great. But the controversy comes in because creatine also causes you to gain a minor amount of weight. And climbers are very fastidious about their weight, typically. So creatine, when we store it in our muscles, is stored in the presence of water. And that water adds a little bit of extra weight to your body, typically around 2 to 5 pounds or 1 to 2 or 3 kilograms. It's a very minor amount. It's minor enough that it seems unlikely that it would actually cause the debilitating problems that people sometimes think that creatine would cause.
Yeah, this is the number one reason people say, when I mention creatine, that they are skeptical about trying it, is that that almost immediately they either say, "Oh, I don't want to put a load of muscle on," because this creatine is normally used in kind of the bodybuilding scene because it allows you just to train a lot harder, and also because of the hydration effect, is that there is a case that you look a little bit more swole. So there's this worry that it's going to make you put on more muscle. That is not going to happen. It doesn't make you put on more muscle. It would make you put on more muscle indirectly by allowing you to train harder and lift heavier weights or lift more work, lift more volume, because you have this ability to go harder for longer. That's right. It's muscle gain. I think we need to do a whole podcast on muscle gain for climbing.
For sure.
So there's that effect, but I always, and the other thing is I tend to get a run of questions where it's like, okay, so I understand and I want to use creatine because I can see, or I feel that it has helped my training and it's helped my power output, but should I titrate or stop taking creatine leading up to my competition? And what I say is no. And the reason being is that, and this is the way I kind of explain it, is that say you have someone, let's just say they're 70 kilos, or let's say a typical climber nowadays is about 65 kilos, right? So let's say 65 kilo climber, I say to them, why don't we try creatine in your training protocol and see how you feel? So they take creatine, and after about 2 weeks, they notice that their weight has now gone up about 2 kilos, right? Mm-hmm. But they're feeling fantastic, and most people generally do. I've had one person who didn't feel the effect. But what happens now is that they have been training at 67 kilos, and they're going to keep doing that because their weight is, you know, with all these other factors, diet and lifestyle, their weight is not really fluctuating much more than, let's say, 2 kilos above before they started taking creatine. When they go into competition, obviously there's other factors. Maybe we could lose a bit of body fat leading up to the comp so that they back down to 65 kilos. That's not impossible. But let's say they just go into the competition with this 2 kilos heavier than when they started. The difference is that they've been working for months at this new weight, this new training weight, but with this kind of maxed out power store that they're able to do a lot more. So this is what I say to them, is that if you stop taking creatine leading up to your competition, let's say for 2 weeks, because you want to get a benefit of 2 kilos off your weight, what you then don't have is you don't have the benefits of creatine anymore, because you've now taken your muscles back down to maybe slightly lower, or if at worst, back to baseline of what they were before. So you've now mitigated pretty much all that. It's not to say that this could not be a strategy, that you want to use creatine to maximize your training block, and then when you go into comp, you use that as a means of getting lighter. But I just don't see really that being such an issue. I think the benefits of creatine for anyone who's actually experienced it far outweigh that, and you would want to go into a competition or even just a project that you're doing topped off with creatine, so that you can kick ass. Because inevitably, if you're doing a long trip or long climb or anything, you're going to become dehydrated anyway. So there's going to be a fluctuation of weight, however you like. So that's my take on it, is that there is that you can use it as a training aid and then stop it, but I just don't see really the reason for doing that.
Yeah, I don't either. The benefits of creatine are, for better or for worse, tied directly to your weight. If you lose weight after the cessation of taking creatine, you also lose the benefit. You can't have both the benefit and the loss of weight at the same time. So if you stop taking creatine and you lose that weight, you, by just physiological principle, have also lost the benefit, any benefit that you would gain from that extra creatine. And the benefit of creatine just far outweighs that minor bit of weight. As Tom mentioned, you know, if you're training consistently at 1 to 2 kilograms more or 2 to 5 pounds more, that you you adjust, your body adjusts to that weight. And it's unlikely, or perhaps only in very rare situations, that that small amount of weight gain would actually cause an impediment to your climbing compared to the other advantages that you gain. I mean, you can think, like, we all go to the bathroom while climbing. Sometimes you hold it for a long time. If you could immediately gain a benefit from losing 8 ounces, or, you know, from losing a quarter kilogram or half a kilogram, then every time you urinated or, you know, did something more in the bathroom, you should hypothetically feel an immediate benefit. But that doesn't happen. Our body is pretty good at regulating what, you know, how, where our performance is going to lie based on our standard accustomed weight.
The other thing as well is that for some reason, the thought of having a hydrated muscle is seen as a negative. And that doesn't really make sense at all.
Yeah, it is weird.
Yeah, I mean, this is like, if I said to you, well, look, I can give you a supplement that is going to hydrate your muscles more, then you'll be like, oh, that sounds like a good idea. But but with creatine, for some reason, it's like, oh, this is just dead water weight. No, it's not dead water weight, right? So it's the same, as the same argument can be said for carbohydrates. You take carbohydrates, they get bonded with water to form glycogen. Is that a good thing? Yes, it is a good thing. So, you know, if you can go into a competition with more muscle hydration, this is not a negative thing.
Right.
So
yeah, there's been studies that have shown that the increase in water weight due to creatine actually increases our body's ability to buffer against core temperature increases. It actually helps you stay cooler, not by any, you know, like astounding amount, but it's another way that it can actually improve your performance, especially in a hot environment. It's not like the water isn't doing anything. It's not dead weight. It is serving a purpose.
Yeah. So now, just to get a little bit of perspective on this, we're not saying that creatine is like an anabolic steroid, right?
No.
We're not saying that. Where you will notice, if you have never tried creatine. Oh, and the other thing is to say is creatine is the most research supplement to date. There are tens of thousands, I think. I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say tens of thousands.
There are, yeah, so many studies.
Yeah, so there really is. There is so much data on the safety of creatine. People have now been taking creatine for easily 15
decades.
Years, maybe. Yeah, you know, I have been taking creatine off and on for about, I don't know, maybe 5 years, 5 or 6 years. So that doesn't mean anything, but the point being is that somebody who is sensitive to these sort of things is that it's safe. But like this, is if I could convince my mother to take creatine, I would ask her to take creatine because I think it actually would benefit her.
There's so many random studies that show these benefits, these kind of small benefits in a wide range of situations. There's benefits for pregnancy, benefits for memory. None of them, you know, again, this is a supplement. We're not saying that this is like a wonder drug. It's not, but it has so many small benefits throughout the body.
Yeah. And I always try and explain it a bit like carbohydrate. So when you eat carbohydrates, they become glycogen and get stored in your muscles to be a fuel, right? What it is creatine is the same sort of thing, is that you are storing the substrate. It's not an extra magical thing that has now come in as an alien to the body. We produce creatine in our muscles. This is what is the primary driver of action. What we're doing is we've taken that molecule and we're saying, whereas you could only produce about, I think, 3 to 5 grams per day yourself, what we're saying is, why don't you take 5 grams, which is the standard dose, 5 grams a day on top of your own production, and you basically saturate. So this goes back actually to what has normally done. So there's two ways that well, ultimately, what you're wanting to do is top off your phosphocreatine levels in your muscles. And this can be achieved either by chronically taking creatine, so 5 grams a day, just keep taking it. And after about 2 or 3 weeks, you will start getting those levels. Or what most people do for a quicker effect is that you do a kind of loading protocol. So you take about 20 grams a day, split into 4 doses, and you do that for about a week or 2 weeks. And by then you would have actually saturated your muscle creatine stores. Anything your body doesn't use, you're just going to urinate out. And then after that period, after about a week of doing this loading, what you do is you're just taking 3 to 5 grams a day just to keep those levels topped off. Right. And so from experiences is I have two vegetarian climbers, one vegan who I've worked with, and they both have had the most, they've given me the best feedback on the use of creatine. And where it normally kind of gets expressed is you can tend to see it with things like, and it sounds kind of a bit silly, but, you know, going from being able to knock out, let's say, a certain amount of pull-ups in one go, you might suddenly get like 2 extra pull-ups or 2 or 3 extra pull-ups. And then when you jump down, you feel that you can recover that power much quicker than you did before.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really why the biggest or the most studies done on creatine are normally done with this repeated sprintability. It's this recovery of your top power incredibly fast. So you have this ability to do maximal explosive power. And then when you stop, you recover incredibly quickly and you can push that out again. Mm-hmm. And this is really what creatine, your phosphocreatine system is doing. So this is why creatine as a supplement is really the bee's knees for this. We haven't really come across any other supplement, not we, but sports science, that has had this effect. It really is kind of a very, very cool thing to have come across.
Yeah. Yeah. Creatine is, I think, the, as far as supplements, the maybe supplements that you think of supplements as, or you think of as supplements go, creatine takes the highest marks in my book. There's one other supplement I have on my list that I say beats out creatine, but it's, I think a lot of people might look at it not quite in the same way, or not as a supplement in the same way that creatine is. But I would recommend creatine to pretty much every climber, and it certainly has many significant benefits.
Yeah. The other thing as well is that the majority of studies are done with a version of creatine called creatine monohydrate. And this by far is the one that you really should just take. There are other very fancy creatines, versions of creatine, but it's not worth the money. They don't do anything extra. They're just
never,
really a lot of, yeah, it's just
never
kind of
been shown to have any benefit except for in increasing profits for the manufacturer.
Yeah. So what you'll tend to find is that all good supplement providers will list a company called Creapure, which is a German manufacturer. And this seems to be the de facto place where creatine comes from in terms of the higher quality. I don't know if that's true for you, but it's certainly
every
product I see is Creapure.
We can find other products, but Creapure is the one that you see most consistently. So I got one last supplement on my list, and I think you only have one left on your list as well, because you had six. We've been through five, including the surprise vitamin D.
Yes.
So I'm gonna hazard a guess that we have the same one as
I
number
hope
one.
So. Unless you know some secret supplements that I haven't heard of.
Moon dust. No. Number one supplement that I have, and that I suspect Tom has as well, is carbohydrates.
I had deer antler.
Powdered deer antler. I forgot about that. Oh man, world's most classic testosterone booster.
That's right.
The powdered velvet from a deer's vestigial deer antler.
That's right.
No, carbohydrates.
Okay. Well, so, I mean, do we need to go into much detail about this?
I don't think we need
to
go into
2 hours of a podcast.
If you want detail, you can listen to episode number. Number two of Climb Sci. We talk a lot more. I don't think the reason I say people might not think of this as a supplement is because it's really primarily carbohydrates come from food, and you can certainly get pretty much all the benefit from of carbohydrates just by consuming a higher carbohydrate diet. You don't necessarily need to consume them in a supplemental form. But the reason I put it on the list is because if we're talking about any single thing that you can recommend a climber take, you know, to improve their performance during a climb, or, you know, immediately before a climb, or when they're tired from climbing, it's carbohydrates. Nothing else has as a more potent short-term and then, you know, long-term as well effect.
Yeah. And I think, you know what, I think it's worth you going back and listening to the second podcast, because we just go into to detail of why that's the case.
Exactly. All the details of why that is. Yeah, you can find in that. There's not a lot more. So the carbohydrates, just, you know, supplemental form, there doesn't need to be anything too fancy about them. If you don't want to be eating while you're climbing, it could be a sports drink. If you like, you know, energy type provisions, you could have energy bars or chews or gels. If you interview my friends, they'll tell you that I've been known to just bring a bag of Sour Patch Kids to the crag at times when I, you know, don't have anything better. This isn't to say that I only eat Sour Patch Kids while I'm climbing.
That provides you your malate as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. If it's a long day of climbing, I'm eating plenty of other regular high carbohydrate food as well, and high protein, and, you know, getting my fat as well. I'm eating a diverse diet, but when I'm, you know, at Joe's Valley in between goes on a problem, I have some Sour Patch Kids sitting right next to me, and, you know, I can kind of consume them over, you know, over the period of hours and make sure that my blood glucose and my muscle glycogen is staying as high as possible, which gives me more longevity, more power.
So I let you into a secret. This is, you know, this is how I actually make the money. And you guys can have it for free. It's one of the greatest performance enhancing things that I can give to clients is I literally get them into the habit of having some carbohydrate just before they climb, and specifically in their little break. And you know what? Like, every single person says, "Oh man, I managed to train so much harder. I could do so much more." And I'm like, "Yeah, it's not rocket science. It's called glucose." and unfortunately, because of like media and you know, the fear of carbohydrates, people really are scared. They're scared they're going to get fat on it. They're scared that it's going to give them diabetes. But that's not the case. Listen to our podcast. But yeah, you know, we're not even talking about that much carbohydrate. So one of my favorite things was I had a guy who not a climber, but he was really struggling. He had a plateau with his deadlifts, and so I said to him, "Why don't you just take some shortbread biscuits to the gym, right? And like halfway through your deadlift sets, I just want you to eat one of these shortbread biscuits," right? This is like 30 grams of carbohydrate. Anyway, next day he comes back to me and he's like, "I hit a PR." And I was like, "Yeah, that's what it is. It's glucose. Like, glucose is going to give you that energy. It's going to change, similar to caffeine. It will upregulate your nervous system. It will make reduce your perceived exertion. It stimulates your central nervous system." So, you know, there's good strategies, which we explain, of how to implement carbohydrate. But just try it, like, for once. I mean, the amount of people that I've seen during a climbing session over the years where I'm eating a kind of little muesli bar, and I take kind of those eat natural muesli bars or something, and I've offered them to them. And I said, "Oh, would you like a bar?" No, I don't want a bar. And it baffles me. I mean, I don't understand why somebody, if they're doing like a whole moon board session and they're struggling and I offer you a muesli bar and you say no, don't whine that you don't have any power to climb up, you know. So carbohydrates are going to give you the energy to push yourself harder and train longer and also recover better. So, you know, don't forgo them.
It's true. Yeah, the results, as Tom said, not to kill our golden goose, but the number one piece of advice that I've given, and that, as Tom just related, he's given, is, you know, just time your carbohydrates, increase your carbohydrates, you know, put them, use carbohydrates strategically during your climbing and other training sessions, and you'll be surprised at how much of a difference it makes. That's certainly when I've made that recommendation. That is the recommendation that people most frequently come back and say, wow, that really made a difference.
Yeah, it's good. We might have just lost our business.
Oh, man. Well, we'll see.
Okay. Okay. So we've given you the supplements which we think are most useful in terms of like literal application here. Straight away, you guys have got something like, okay, creatine monohydrate is a really cheap supplement. I think, mm-hmm. you know, what you can do is that if you're really trying to save money, get a couple of mates and share a tub and just try it for, let's say, 3 weeks and see. If it doesn't give you any benefit and you don't feel any benefit, you know, in your training journal, then drop it. I've met one person, a high-end climber, who he tried it, and he just didn't find any benefit. And when I had recommended it, this was the second time someone had recommended, and he just didn't like it. So that for him, it didn't. And there are some people who don't respond, and I don't think we know why. You've got your carbohydrates, which was explained. Again, you can try the beta-alanine. That's going to be something that you need to do over time. So you may only feel the results probably in, what, three to four weeks, maybe. And then caffeine again. So, I mean, this is where, like, this is the funny thing is it's a weird kind of, it's not rocket science. So you've done a climbing session, I'd say a bouldering session or whatever, and then you have a break. And what you do is you have a cup of coffee and, a few biscuits or something. And then you go back to your problem and you realize how much easier that problem felt, right? A lot of people have experienced this. What you've done is sports nutrition. Like high-end sports nutrition. You've got your carbohydrates in there, you've got your
cutting edge.
And you're hitting these two major things. If you mm-hmm. couple this with having creatine, so I take a scoop, 5 grams of creatine before bed. And the only reason I do that is just because I keep my creatine by my sink, and it's a habitual thing. I just neck the creatine down. And you don't have to do, I literally dump it in my mouth and swish it down with water. It doesn't actually taste of anything.
It doesn't taste like anything.
Yeah. So, I mean, I really would say that for instance, if you were to do on your training, if you were to implement just those three, that would be great. Again, Brian is more of a beta alanine guy. So,
it's worth taking. It's also very cheap, and it's not going to give you as much of a benefit as carbohydrates or creatine will. Or as noticeable of an immediate benefit as something like caffeine, but it will make a difference to you, especially if you're a sport climber. If you're a boulderer, it's got maybe a little bit less application, just because, again, it's an intramuscular buffer. Your muscles aren't necessarily going to reach the level where it is going to be effective. But most boulderers train, and you'll get benefit out of training while on it. So I think on the balance, it's worth taking. Mm.
Good, good. So I don't know. I mean, I was wondering if I should ask this or not. I mean, you can say no. Is there anything else that you personally take, or is that not a good thing to bring up? Just to confuse people.
For performance, no. Those are the things I take for performance are creatine and beta alanine. I'll mix those into a protein shake, usually, just because I tend to have like one protein shake a day. And if I don't, then I'll mix them into water. Beta alanine is also tasteless. It's another tasteless powder. So they're both very easy to take. I have my regular high carbohydrate diet. If I'm climbing for an extended period of time, I'll bring some form of supplemental carbs to make sure that I stay topped off, as it were. And I'll have, depending on what time of day it is and, you know, what I'm doing, I'll take caffeine. But it's usually in the form of tea or coffee. Every now and again, I've got this sports mix that I get as a form of payment. So from a company that I write articles for sometimes, and I'll take that. But I don't take it because I take it mostly for its caffeine, and it's got a pleasant flavor. But everything else in it is kind of redundant to what I'm already taking. I think it's got some creatine in it and some other stuff. It's a pretty standard pre-workout drink. I do take citrulline malate sometimes. I'll mix that specifically with that drink because I think it makes it taste a little bit better. It gives it a little bit more of a sour punch, like a punch that is sour, not like a sour punch flavor. and I like that. I didn't include citrulline malate on this list, though, because I think it does have a benefit, or I think it very likely has a benefit, I should say. But there's so many fewer studies out there on it. And it's kind of a, if it does have a benefit, it's probably a much lower benefit. Citrulline malate, just to say very briefly, the benefit that it would have is citrulline is part of this, it's going to effectively increase arginine in your blood, which hypothetically will increase the production of nitric oxide and, kind of give you the benefit of blood vessel dilation. So there are some studies that suggest that it is beneficial. I wouldn't ever recommend against it necessarily, because I think it also has the, like I said, the benefit of improving the flavor of sports drinks. But I also wouldn't say go out there and definitely buy it. That is reserved for carbohydrates, creatine, beta alanine. Caffeine, if you already are a consumer, or if you want to, test it to see how it affects your training or competitions. And if you are bold and willing to take the risk, sodium bicarbonate, but only if you test it out beforehand, never just as a, I'm going to do this on a whim because I really want to compete hard.
Yeah, that's not a good idea. Yeah.
How about you? Is there anything that you take sports performance specific wise?
So for performance, the only one I do try and I have tried and I do keep it in my kind of arsenal is something called alpha GPC or glycerol phosphocholine.
Keto glutarate.
No. So this is without the keto bit. This is alpha glycerol phosphocholine.
Okay.
So basically, this is kind of it just increases. So your nervous system runs on something called acetylcholine. It increases choline levels. Choline is something you find in eggs, but if you're taking a supplement like anything, you're providing a super dose. There's some data to show that alpha GPC is a kind of nootropic. It's very big in the nootropic kind of scene. It's very safe and has some data on it improving power output. I sometimes take it when I just remember to take it, and I take it about an hour before I train, but it's definitely not a regular thing. So I just find that it makes me more alert. And I'm certainly not going to take, for instance, creatine at 7 o'clock. Caffeine at 7 o'clock.
Right.
So yeah. Instead, I take that, and it doesn't, for it being to a kind of a nervous system stimulant, it doesn't make me feel anxiety or anything like that.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I mean, there's something to worth. It. Yeah. So I get mine from Jarrow. So they have like a 300 milligram alpha GPC, but that's the only performance one I take. I do take taurine regularly, like 3 grams of taurine every day. And I normally do that at night, and that's just really for kind of health benefits. And it's worth people looking up online. There's a lot of different investigations on the benefits of taurine in things like glycemia and oxidative stress and things like that.
Yeah. We'll have another episode, I'm sure, in the future on supplements for general health.
Yeah, I think so. And maybe we'll do one as well on, I think actually what we can do, but would be a good one, is on supplements that can benefit recovery. I think that would be a good
topic. Well, I think we'll be probably talking about recovery sometime in the near future, either way. And we'll get into that.
Good. So So I think we've given you a lot. Probably people are probably thinking about, they're probably thinking, why have you guys not mentioned whey protein? But we are assuming that whey protein as a supplement is not necessarily a performance improver. I almost recommend to 100% of my clients to try whey protein just because it helps them hit our protein target, which might be trickier.
Yeah.
So yeah, whey protein or pea or vegetable source protein, as we talk about in podcast one, is a supplement that we would both highly recommend, really. And it's on my list as a kind of as an afterthought to be mentioned there. But I think that's everything from me. Brian?
Me as well.
Okay, my clock, my phone ran out of juice, so I have no
idea. Oh, we're at about 2 hours. Oh, so,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I felt good to me. Yeah. We didn't get any, as I explained last episode, we explained last episode, we're typically going to try to answer questions you have about the previous episode at the beginning of, the episode, the subsequent episode. We did not get any questions about cardio, as far as I know, though. I didn't get any directly.
No, I didn't know.
So we don't have any questions. Normally, we'll do those before we get into the meat of the episode. But I mentioned this not because we have any questions to answer, but to remind you, as a listener, to think of some questions if you have any. If there's anything that you were wondering about that Tom and I didn't address, please send them our way. We are more than happy to answer them off.
Definitely. So I had one random question the other day when somebody friended me on Facebook and said, I really loved you in a certain famous climbing movie. And I was like, no, I'm not the Tom Herbert that you think I am. if you've never seen the video of this, and to be honest, I think the famous climber Tom Herbert is from California, so surely you shouldn't assume that that this is a Californian accent. But no, I'm not Tom Herbert, the famous climber. I just happened to share the name. that's the only thing I had to clear up. But
fair enough.
Yeah. But guys, please. I recommend heading over to Brian's website, Climbing Nutrition. He's been building up a supplement guides, and he talks about some other things there, which is really good. He has citrulline malate there, if you're wondering what that is.
I've got dosage, physiological effects. They're all pretty in depth and referenced, so that if you are curious, you can follow back. They'll give you, I don't want to say more depth than what you got here. In some cases, perhaps a little bit more, but it's in a written form. It's a little bit easier to reference than maybe trying to find the exact minute that we discuss it here. So if you just have a question about that, about a specific supplement or how it works, then that's a great place to drop by, climbingnutrition.com, and you can just type in whatever supplement into the search bar and the appropriate guide will pull up.
Yep. And then I'll go again. I recommend in terms of if you're a competitive athlete, you need to do a Google for the WADA prohibited list. Mm-hmm. That will pop up. And then the other company is called Informed Sport or Informed Choice. Mm-hmm. And that will be the certification and the testing for that. Again, if you have any questions about the safety of supplements, please do contact us. We're happy to help. I recommend with all of these supplements that we've listed, it's better to buy them as single supplements rather than mixes. It's just much easier and you don't get a whole bunch of weird stuff.
Yeah. So much easier to dose, much cheaper really in the long run.
Exactly. Again, please get involved with the podcast, giving us some questions and things. Go to facebook.com/climbingnutrition and you can leave questions on Brian's page or facebook.com/usefulcoach. You can do that on mine. If you want to look at that study I mentioned about the vegan vegetarian female, I think they were rowers. Oh, no, I can't remember. But have a look at, yeah, in instagram.com/usefulcoach, and it's the second thing I've posted that gives you the link to that study, which is quite cool. Yes, I think that's it.
All right. Well, if you have been following announcements on Facebook, we have moved to, hopefully it should be once a month, releasing on the final Friday. Obviously, this one will not be. This was supposed to be released last Friday, but life gets in the way sometimes. I was on vacation and there was just some scheduling issues. But hopefully there should be a new episode after this one coming out Friday, May 25th. Topic as of yet unannounced. So keep follow us on Climbing Nutrition's Facebook page or Useful Coaches, and we'll let you know when we get a topic decided and what we're going to be talking about. And definitely think of questions and leave some for us.
Cool. That's it. All right. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah. Thanks so much for listening. And we'll see you again in about a month.
Ciao.